ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Have you heard the term authenticity being bandied about in your workplace? What did you think? Should you really bring your whole self to work? Hello, I'm Lisa Leong, and this is ABC Radio National's This Working Life, helping to make your work life better. So this week on LinkedIn, I asked you whether you should really bring your whole self to work. And there were some excellent reflections. Thank you very much. So let's dive in. Dr. Thomas Tomorrow Premusic is a professor of business psychology at University College London and Columbia University, and the author of Don't Be Yourself, Why Authenticity is Overrated and What to Do Instead. Welcome back to This Working Life, Thomas.
Hi, nice to see you.
And Juliana Pillemer is an assistant professor of management and organisations at NYU Stern School of Business. She researches relationships at work and authenticity. Hi, Juliana.
Nice to be here.
So, Thomas, how did we get to the point where authenticity has become so highly prized at work?
I think it's just part of the narcissistic kind of culture and zeitgeist that we're living in, you know? Individualism sounds great. It also sounds great to have, jobs or even careers where you can bring your whole self to work in principle. But if you take that to the extreme, actually people might miss an important point, which is that at some point, the right to be you ends and your obligation to others begins. Other people will trust you, not if you unleash your unfiltered and uninhibited self on them, but if you're reliable, safe, and show that you have their best interests at heart. So I think, you know, this sort of narcissistic ideal that you should just be you and the rest of the world should adapt needs to be challenged. That's the point of my last book.
What's your definition of authenticity then, Thomas?
There's actually no objective way to quantify authenticity. In decades of research, there have been two approaches. One is to ask people whether they feel authentic, but that's as unreliable as to ask them if they're funny, creative, or a good person. You know, even the most hostile and toxic people in the world will define themselves as nice human beings, so we can't trust self-reports. And then the other kind of approach, which is far more consequential, is to ask other people whether they think you are authentic. And if you look at that line of research, which is, of course, more important because you get promoted, hired, demoted, or fired, not based on what you think of yourself, but based on what other people think of you, what you realize is that the people who are deemed authentic by others actually make a big effort to adjust their behavior to fit the situational demands. So they might be faking it, but they have the social skills to seem genuine while they are faking it.
Juliana, in your research, you write about strategic authenticity. What is this?
First of all, my definition of authenticity is a subjective alignment, right? So I'll acknowledge it's subjective, right? There is no objective authenticity, but a subjective alignment between your inner states and external expressions, right? This can be something you feel or other people perceive about you. So we're in alignment there. Strategic authenticity, I think, had the same, you know, ideas that Thomas had, which is just like, we value this thing so much and it's really complicated. I have a great quote from Bob Mackie, who's the founder of Whole Foods, who says, being authenticity is not an easy thing. You know, it's a razor's edge. I really have to think about it. And that kind of goes against what we actually conceive of as being genuine, right? If you have to think about it so much, then is it actually authenticity at all? You know, and then at the same time, authenticity is super desirable, right? We can't ignore that. At the individual level, at the relational level, which I study for organizations, being seen as authentic, it gets you a lot. Right? And we can see this playing out in our society right now across so many different dimensions. There's kind of two things happening at once. There's this increasing demand to be seen as authentic, and there's this increasing, you know, demand that's always been there, which is to adhere to professional norms, to be seen as a team player, to, you know, do everything that Tomas was just saying. And strategic authenticity is the difficult dance that we do to try to achieve both of those self-presentational goals at once.
Thomas, you've written about four authenticity traps at work, and bringing your whole self to work is one of them. I really want to unpack this a bit. So what are the downsides, as you see it, of bringing your whole self to work?
Our self-concept is multidimensional. Let me talk about myself, who is the person that I might know better than anybody else, but I'm not that sure about that. But, you know, there's the me that is a manager, a leader, an academic, a founder. But there's also me who is a son, a father, a friend. And, you know, there are so many dimensions to our self-concept, which is a beautiful thing to kind of human individuality. And work is not an invitation to display all of these dimensions. And it even starts with a job interview. If young people who are listening to us think that a job interview is an invitation to display every single aspect of their self-concept or unleash their inhibited and uninhibited and uncensored self on others, they're going to be not just unemployed, but unemployable, you know? So just like the interview is an invitation to show that you understand the dominant social etiquette and you can display social or emotional skills to get the job, the same applies to work. The other one is that our whole self also contains undesirable, dark side, negative tendencies, you know. I don't know the two of you well enough, but let me talk about myself. You know, my whole self includes grumpy me, opinionated me, impulsive me, unbearable me. You know, some of these aspects of my whole self are not even welcomed at home. My family are very, very happy if I can take it somewhere else, preferably not to work so I can keep a job, you know? So, I mean, that's the gist of it.
And just on that point, so I know that some people might argue, okay, so I'm grumpy and I've got opinions. Yeah. Shouldn't I be speaking my truth?
No, you shouldn't. Work is called work for a reason. You're supposed to deliver for, you know, this shouldn't be controversial. Now, what's interesting really is that the bring your whole self to work ideal has been hijacked, if not co-opted or weaponized, by the diversity and inclusion movement. I think with good intentions. After all, you know, it would be nice to make people who are part of the out-group or low-status individuals feel that they're free to express themselves and that they shouldn't feel alienated. The reality is that authenticity, whether we like it or not, has always been a privilege for the elite, for the status quo. And pointing the finger at people who are part of the minority or an out-group or low-status people and say, yeah, just be you, when it's not safe to do so, it's irresponsible and unethical.
So we asked you on LinkedIn for your take on the idea of bringing your whole self to work, and here's a couple of them. So we've got Scott first.
Workplace authenticity can be risky. I've seen leaders humble bragging to act and fake authenticity while sharing vulnerabilities they've selected to make themselves look good. So as a rule, it's an old Jungian rule, all behaviour and meaning are context dependent. So instead of setting out to always, always be authentic, it might be wise to practice some small, safe, like personal tests to figure out when it is safe.
And here's Katie.
When you employ people, you are employing human beings who have complex lives, complex brains, that we don't switch things on and off when we're in the workplace or if our workplace is remote. Ultimately, I think this only happens in workplaces where it's deemed safe, and it's only made safe when people in positions of power ultimately demonstrate this themselves.
So, Juliana, there's a power dynamic going on here when it comes to authenticity at work. What did you notice about what has come through in Scott and Katie's reflections?
I completely agree with this idea of the safe test that Scott talked about. I prefer to think about authenticity as a spectrum, not an all or nothing thing. So I like to think of bringing more of yourself to work.
Let's go a little bit deeper because you do have two specific ways people show authenticity. Do you want to go through the two?
I think there's the kind of the Oprah type of authenticity, right? Which is, if we think of authenticity as this alignment between what's on the inside and what I'm expressing outwardly, I just tell you. Right? I cry, or I'm transparent, or I say, in an organizational setting, that might look like, hey, you know, I really actually don't like this organizational initiative, right? It doesn't have to be some extreme wild thing, right? But it can be this minor way of sort of sharing what's on the inside, right? Whether it's emotional or sort of more cognitive, that allowed him then to connect with people by conveying that, right? And so I'm not saying this is good or bad, right? I'm just saying that there are these kind of two ways, self-expressions and social deviations, that people signal their authenticity to others.
Thomas, you write that we should value emotional intelligence over authenticity. Why?
What is important is whether we can predict what somebody is going to do. And people with higher emotional intelligence are in a way more boring and predictable, but also more prosocial. You can basically bet that they will have a modicum adherence to the social etiquette and display empathy, interest in others. Even if they're faking it, they're going to behave in prosocial ways. So I don't care if you're authentic, if you're nice. I'd rather live with somebody who is fake but prosocial than somebody who is authentically obnoxious.
Now, there's an important point here as well about this concept of authenticity underpinned by an assumption of some degree of self-awareness, which is possibly a dangerous assumption there. So can you talk us through that?
Yeah, sure. And I think, well, and again, let me just kind of reiterate something that Juliana said, which is it's all about the nuance and degrees, right? I mean, no trait or attribute, whether good or bad, is definitive or categorical. It's always a matter of degrees. And also, even good things are bad when taken to the extreme. Having said that, when it comes to self-awareness, there are, again, two different approaches to evaluating it. One is the introspective school, which is, do you feel like you know yourself? And, you know, the Beatles checked into an ashram in India and experimented with psychedelics. Others engage in mindfulness, discipline, whatever. So, you know, there's the introspective. But I think the more pragmatic approach is the interpersonal approach, which is you are self-aware if you understand how people see you. Now, by definition, that requires you to focus a lot on what other people think of you, to be other-oriented. Mm. And when you do that, you will typically adjust or modulate your behavior to fit the situation or circumstances. With authenticity, there's a great paradox, which is like, how can we ask people to be truly honest with others if they are actually bullshitting themselves? The people who are most effective and impactful and get to be prime minister or president, they're not lying to you, they're lying to themselves, and that's why their self-deception becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
You're listening to This Working Life on ABC Radio National. I'm Lisa Leong. My guests are Thomas Chamorro Premusic, Professor of Business Psychology at University College London and Columbia University, and Juliana Pilama from NYU Stern School of Business. Let's go to generational differences now. So, Juliana, are generational differences making authenticity more highly prized, do you think?
I myself am a millennial, right? I am a professor. I teach undergrads, and I'm going to use a window into Gen Z. And I do think that there is a generational difference here, that I think it's becoming increasingly prized, this idea of authenticity, such that Gen Z, I actually just looked up, there's some poll, now we take every poll with a grain of salt, right? It's not a scientific study, but some poll that said, you know, 92% of Gen Zers list say it's really important to be authentic, right? Like, this is their number one value. And I actually think my generation too, millennials, we were the ones who kind of started this whole thing. You know, I do think that this blending of your work self and your home self kind of, I also study friendship at work and relationships, right? And I think that it's really hard to actually genuinely connect with someone if you're connecting with some fake version of them, right? So you have to reveal some aspect of yourself. And that's the power of authenticity, along with stuff like emotional intelligence, right? And so it doesn't need to be one or the other. It's kind of both. You have to give some of yourself and give some of the other. But yeah, I think what remains to be seen, and again, this is from my experience teaching hundreds of you know, folks in their early 20s and reading about it, is whether Gen Z's value of authenticity will translate to whether they feel like they need it at work. right? So I know they feel like they need it in their life. I just don't, you know, we've also lived through COVID and remote work. And I know that actually compared to other generations, Gen Z might value close relationships less in the work, folks.
Thomas, there's actually been a lot of coverage in the media about a perceived lack of professionalism from younger generations who aren't seemingly willing to conform. Do you see this as a form of authenticity?
I'm uncomfortable with generations in either direction, you know, because I think even if you have, first of all, when we look at kind of so-called generational differences or surveys on generational differences, a lot of the times they're not capable of disentangling age and generations. If you ask people in their 20s what they want today, you know, is not so different from people in their 20s. 30, 50, 100 years ago, there are some studies that show some differences in actual generations when you survey 20-year-olds today versus 20-year-olds in the 80s, 60s, whatever. And actually what those studies show is that aspirations keep on increasing, even though the world of work is improving a lot, you know. The average assembly line worker 100 years ago would not have gotten home after a day in the factory and complained to their spouse that today they didn't find a sense of calling or a higher sense of purpose. You know, it would be like, you know, you clock in and out. And now it's a given. If you don't find it in a day or your manager says something that challenges your values, you should quit or quietly quit, you know. So that's because standards have improved, but I think expectations improve in turn. And there is some worrying data by Jean Twenge and others showing that actually that rise in aspirations isn't accompanied with a rise in work ethic or actual kind of motivation. So, you know, if you get high aspirations without a high work ethic, that's called entitlement, and that is a preoccupation.
All right, let's go to who should we be at work then? Here's what regular guest Megumi Miki, author of Quietly Powerful, thinks you might miss out on if you are fully authentic at work.
If you're just being yourself, then you might bring your most comfortable and potentially worst side of yourself. So, for instance, if I was being my comfortable self, I might not do any public speaking. I might sit in the corner and not saying a thing. I might just listen and observe and take notes. And, you know, people might be wondering what I'm doing because I'm not really saying anything. So that's not going to be helpful.
So that's Megumi Miki. She's the author of Quietly Powerful. Thomas, I feel like you're aligned to Megumi in that you argue that we should be our best self at work. So say more about this.
Fully aligned, and also not just because of that, you know, there is clearly willingness to be your best self, not your whole self, or, you know, to at least keep some aspects of yourself hidden or at home and tame them. But I even think, like, from an evolutionary perspective, why limit yourself to your past and present self if you can also try to broaden or expand or diversify yourself? And she gave some really good examples. For me, you know, I think it's like, there are so many, public speaking is a good one, but if you're like a person who typically dominates meetings and speaks, and that's just who you are, wouldn't it be better to learn to shut up and listen and let other people talk? Going outside of your comfort zone and doing things that are natural and inauthentic because they don't match your current identity is a way to evolve and to expand. And I think especially if you're a leader, you should be looking at that. The best leaders in the world in any area learn to go against their nature because they're not limited by their so-called past or present selves.
Mm, I love that concept, and it's really helpful because I have over time learnt to sit back and listen more, so to be a more enlightened extrovert, as they say. But now I would say that that's become my natural self. I might have had to try really hard at the start, but you know, it is who I am now.
Yeah.
All right. Jeremy has an interesting idea too. Here's Jeremy.
I really like the term curated authentic self. Like, you know, the authentic self that I bring depends on the context. So I curate a different authentic self if I'm at home with my partner versus with my mum versus with my grandma versus if I'm out with some friends or versus when I'm at work or in a professional business setting.
This reminds me of David Bowie's view of his identity, Thomas, that you write about in your book. So tell us about this.
So, you know, the great David Bowie was known for reinventing himself or his artistic persona every year. And so he would go from funk to rock to pop to electronic. And with every incursion into a new musical genre, he would invent a totally different artistic persona. And at some point, I think it was a BBC journalist who asked him, "But who are you really? Which one is you?" And, you know, his answer was as brilliant as his artistic creations. He said, "I am only the person the greatest number of people think I am." And, you know, the reality is that our reputation is basically dispersed in the eyes of others. It's a really, really important kind of a metaphor or story to remind people that what matters most is not what they think of themselves, but how other people perceive them, which, by the way, will include whether they see you as genuine. If you're overdoing your political skills so much that you seem like a politician, you'll be labeled a phony, an empty suit, and nobody will trust you. So there is a risk to kind of being extremely fake and not having the social skills to engage in what I think, Juliana, you call strategic authenticity.
I can't top a David Bowie example, but I think, like, one of the scholars that I admire who write about this, Herminia Ibarra, she has this concept called a provisional self. So we try on identities, we see if it sticks, and then ultimately we can kind of bring it into our own self-concept, right? And I love this idea because it makes it more playful, right? And so it's not about stagnating and it's not about being something you're not. It's about how can we push ourselves and grow. And I actually think there's a way to reconcile that and make that be about authenticity too, because you can have, yeah, this is the way I am, but I have this higher level value of pushing myself, right? Like, this is important to me. And so you integrate that as part of your identity, and then that allows you to play around with it. And so I think that's a way that we can kind of blend those two seemingly opposing ideas into one.
Okay, we ask our guests every week for a tip that This Working Lifers can try this week, and it's called Try This. Thomas, how do you learn to be your best self at work? What's your tip for us?
Oh, I think you have to, like, try not to be an asshole and be nice and listen to others and get feedback and, you know, control yourself, learn to manage yourself, you know, anger management, impulsivity, etc. Be more other oriented. A very, very simple but difficult to implement advice is shut up more and listen more.
Just leaving a pause there.
If it was so easy, everybody would do it.
Okay, Juliana, what's your tip for practicing strategic authenticity, please?
I have a two-part homework assignment, so hopefully this isn't too much for folks. But I would say thinking first about being honest with yourself, reflecting on where you fall, and kind of, I think there's a spectrum from, are you overly authentic at work, which Tomas has talked a lot about, you know, you're giving a little too much of yourself. And then there's sort of professionalism side of that. Are you maybe holding back a lot? Are you stiff? Are you phony? Are you just not giving any of who you are, and therefore maybe potentially limiting yourself, especially in terms of your relationships and, you know, the benefits that can come from that? Part one is kind of identify, be honest with yourself where you are in that spectrum. And then two would be think about a way to sort of bring more of yourself to work in a way that wouldn't undermine those professional norms, right? So again, not going too crazy with it, but yeah, thinking of a way to either share more about yourself or deviate from a script in a way that might make others feel a little bit easier to connect with you, and therefore work in service of kind of being more pro-social and more emotionally intelligent.
Thank you, Juliana.
Thank you so much.
And thank you, Thomas.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Thomas Chamorro, Prem Music, is the author of Don't Be Yourself, Why Authenticity is Overrated and What to Do Instead. And Juliana Pillemer is an assistant professor of management and organisations at NYU Stern School of Business. If you spend some of your week working from home, how are you managing that space? Whether you work on the kitchen table or you have a separate office space at home, things can really build up. So it might be time for a spring clean. We've made a special episode of Try This to help you declutter your work from home space. You can find it on the ABC Listen app and take the challenge with me. So on LinkedIn, I actually posted a before picture of my home office, and I'm working on the after photo right now. I'll post it when done. Thanks for listening to ABC Radio National's This Working Life. It was produced by Michelle Weeks and engineered by Brendan O'Neill on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Naarm, Melbourne. If you like what you heard, subscribe to our podcast and please share it with a colleague or a friend. You can do that on the ABC Listen app or anywhere you listen to podcasts. I'm Lisa Leong, and until next time, work it like a charm.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.